Nightingale Conant presents Training the Mind, Healing the Body with Drs. Deepak Chopra and David Simon. In this informative and practical course, you'll explore natural holistic approaches for creating and preserving health with two of the world's foremost experts on mind-body medicine. Dr. Deepak Chopra is the leading exponent of the role of consciousness in the dynamics of healing. He is an internationally acclaimed speaker, a best-selling author, and he is educational director of the Chopra Center for Well-Being in La Jolla, California. For over a decade, his partner in disseminating ancient healing wisdom for today has been Dr. David Simon, medical director for the Chopra Center for Well-Being. A board-certified neurologist, Dr. Simon supervises the training of healthcare providers from around the world in the principles and practices of mind-body medicine. Here now with an introduction is Dr. David Simon.
So welcome to this journey into healing. There's a story about a great Ayurvedic sage named Jivaka. When he was a medical student, his teacher assigned the class the task of going out into the environment and bringing back a few things that had no medicinal value. So within an hour or so, all the students in the class came back with this twig or this rock or this bug, but no one could find Jivaka. So everyone was waiting, hours went by, students were getting somewhat frustrated. At the end of the day, there was still no Jivaka, so they retired the class, came back the next day, another day went by, same story, all the students were really cussing under their breaths, where was this guy? And then a few days later, Jivaka came back and he was empty-handed. And again, the students were very upset, we wasted our time for the last few days, you know, where have you been? And then, demonstrating his understanding of life, he said, I couldn't find anything that didn't have some influence on health. I looked at the rocks and I understood that there were minerals within those rocks that could have a healing impact on our lives. I looked at every plant, every weed that I could find, and as I experienced the power of that plant, I realized there was something there for us. I looked at every animal, every bird, every mammal, every lizard, and knew that everything that I put my attention on was in some way changing my state of being. I looked at the sun and the moon and the stars and the clouds and realized that everything that I brought into my awareness changed who I was and was metabolized into a new form of who I was. So I couldn't find anything that didn't in some way or another impact my health. And this is the framework of Ayurveda that we really hope to impart to you over the next few days. Not so much Ayurveda as an alternative medical system, because we don't really see it as such, but as providing this unifying framework that integrates the environment, our senses, our body, our minds, our emotions, and our spirit. And that when we really begin to think in these terms, we'll see that, like Jivaka, everything that we put our attention on can have an influence on our well-being, and we really will be holistic in our lives and in our practices. So what do we hope to accomplish? One thing that we hope to accomplish is to create the understanding that healing occurs at many different levels. There's this expression, it says, if the only tool that you have in your tool chest is a hammer, then everything starts to look like a nail. And I think one thing that we've seen in this whole world of healing is that everybody has their hammer. For a medical doctor, it may be a prescription pad. For a chiropractor, it's a spinal adjustment. For a homeopath, it's a tincture, a miasmic tincture. For a hypnotherapist, it's an induction of a chant. For an acupuncturist, it may be acupuncture needles. But true healing means choosing the right tool for the right concern and not trying to impose one particular structure on everybody's issues. So one of our goals here this week really is to provide you with new tools, so that you can perhaps choose a subtler intervention when it's appropriate without relinquishing the more powerful tools that may be appropriate in other circumstances. We really want to try to break down the barriers between disciplines. This framework that we're going to be operating within is really a very holistic one, because it utilizes everything in our environment, outer and inner, to establish increasing levels of balance and integration in our lives. Ultimately, we're making a shift from a very material-based view of the world to what we call a consciousness-based paradigm. Since probably the time of Isaac Newton, perhaps a little bit before, we've had this idea that life is the byproduct of molecular interactions. You get a bunch of molecules together, they collide, they form certain boundaries and bonds, and through some very sophisticated and basically unimaginable process, we eventually create human beings, awareness, love, emotions, joyfulness. We're making a new shift now, and it's really reflecting in every aspect of our lives, that consciousness is really the primary substance of the universe. When we look at the world from a material perspective, then it makes complete sense that our only interventions have been material-based interventions. If the body is just a physical machine, then of course we're going to interact with it in the same way that we would bring our car into an auto repair shop. We'd want to clear out the fuel line or replace a broken part. But if we begin to understand that the body is really a network of energy and information, constantly exchanging intelligence with the universe, then it begins to open up the possibility of how to create greater balance, create healing in the mind and in the body through choices and behaviors. We are the sum total of the choices that we've made up until this point. And if we want to change who we are, then we just simply need to begin to make new choices, new interpretations, new perceptions. I think that we all agree that there's probably no one who has created the conversation around this better than Dr. Deepak Chopra. Deepak's really been this remarkable translator of this ageless healing wisdom into language that in this modern age of fax machines and cellular telephones and splitting of the atom, we can really understand and integrate. And so really, I consider Deepak to be the professor emeritus of mind-body medicine. So please join me in welcoming Deepak Chopra.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to have you. Welcome to this course. I think we'll have a lot of fun besides uncovering a lot of stuff that we already know. At some level, everyone knows what's going to be taught for the rest of this week. But I think what you'll get is a very good theoretical framework which you can use not only to employ these healing techniques that you learn for yourself, but also for your clients and patients. So this is a very exciting course for both me and David, because we're going to use the Ayurvedic framework to explain everything to you. But if I think I was to choose another expression for this, it would be consciousness-based medicine. And even as we go into what that really means, I think it's important to go a little bit into the historical background of how consciousness-based medicine emerged and is continuing to evolve and will continue to evolve. And we need to go into a little bit of history into just the understanding of paradigms in general. Thomas Kuhn, who was a philosopher and a scientist at the same time, coined this word paradigm. And paradigm means a conceptual framework, a map. When you want to explore a certain kind of territory, then you need a map in order to explore that territory. So a paradigm is really a map, and we should always remember that the map is not the territory. However, the map allows us to explore a certain type of territory. If you don't have the map, then you're unlikely to knowingly explore that territory. And as we've evolved over the last several million years into who we are right now, Homo sapiens and conscious beings, there have been periods in our history where the paradigm has changed. And as the paradigm has changed, then the territory that we've explored has also changed, or the way we've explored that territory has been changing and evolving. Thomas Kuhn made a very important statement when he said that data, so-called scientific data, is not just lying around there for us to look at objectively. We summon forth the kind of data, even in our scientific methodologies, we summon forth the kind of data that reinforces our paradigm. So our conceptual framework allows us to elicit from what is essentially a quantum field, or you might say a field of infinite possibilities, we selectively choose the data that reinforces our map, our concept of what we think exists out there. And that's how all scientific investigation proceeds. And over the last several million years, that paradigm has shifted and has gone through many phases. So if we look to anthropologists and ask them what's the history of our species, incidentally, there's a lot of controversy even about that. But most people will say that Homo sapiens, which is human beings, as distinguished from Homo erectus, which was when apes began to stand and walk, but Homo sapiens is when we started to actually think and create and conceptualize. Homo sapiens have existed for at least several hundred thousand years, possibly several million years. There's controversy about that. And for most of our evolutionary history, for the several hundred thousand years or million years that we've been around as Homo sapiens, we were hunter-gatherers. We were either hunting or we were gathering. We were basically living in a very predatory environment, and we were also surrounded by predators who thought it was a great idea to have us for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so in order to survive, we developed this biological response, which is known as the fight-flight response. In a threatening situation, we learned how to run or fight, and that's why we survived. And this response is controlled by a part of our brain, which is also known as the brain's brain. It's called the limbic system, and it controls basic instinctual and survival responses. And David will tell you that when we were in medical school, the way we remembered the functions of the limbic system were the four F's: feeding, fighting, fleeing, and the physical act that's responsible for the procreation of our species. So, for millions of years, hundreds of thousands of years, that response dominated our awareness, our biology, our genetic structure, and is still really the most powerful response in our physiology. So the first phase of our evolution as human beings was hunter-gatherers. But around 6,000 years ago, something dramatic happened in our evolutionary history. As humans, we discovered first horticulture and then agriculture. And with the discovery of horticulture, which was just the knowledge that you could take a stick, you could bore a hole in the ground, you could put seeds there, and then these seeds would sprout, and what you got out of that was something you could eat. Agriculture came a little later, where humans discovered that you could use animals, and you could have a plow that could be driven by an animal, and then you could actually increase your wealth in terms of what there was available to eat. So the age of horticulture first and the age of agriculture second. Around the age of horticulture, there is the emergence amongst human beings, the concept of gods and goddesses, deities. Humans began to pray to gods and goddesses to bring them abundant rain and good environment so that their seeds would sprout into abundant fruit and agricultural products, grain and so on. And then with the age of agriculture, more time available, and this happened, as I said, almost 6,000 years. And around this time, we have the emergence around the globe, around our whole planet, of what have come to be known as the axial sages. So the axial sages, because they all appeared around the whole planet, around the same time in our evolutionary history. We can start in the East with Lao Tzu and Confucius and the Indian sages of the Rig Veda and later the Upanishads. And we have in the West the thinkers like Pythagoras and Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. And we have Moses in the Middle East. And then many centuries later, we have great prophets like Muhammad and Christ. And in the Indian realm, the Ramayana and Mahabharata, the names Krishna and Ram, and we have Buddha, of course, and many, many others. I can't even name all these great thinkers that emerged around the same period, if we say this is within the last 6,000 years. And with this new phase, the paradigm again shifted. The paradigm shifted into a worldview that looked at divine forces ruling what happened in the material universe, invisible forces. And because all these axial sages had a technology to access that invisible world, whatever their methodology might have been, there were similarities. The experiences that come with silence and meditation, the meditative disciplines, the origins of yoga. Incidentally, the word yoga is related to the word yoke and the Latin derivative of that, which means union between body, mind, soul, spirit, and the universe, physical universe. So it is during this period that we also learned to elicit, as human beings, a different biological response than just the fight-flight response. The fight-flight response was based on fear and came out of a necessity for survival. And then during a later period, the fight-flight response manifested in humans also as something called the reactive response, which is the fight-flight response in disguise. A reaction to a stimulus basically with survival as the basic need. And reactive response are things like our control dramas, confrontation, intimidation, indifference, stubbornness, cunning, ruthlessness. These are the control dramas that humans participate in. And the essential basis for that is again survival. But beyond the reactive response, during the time that our evolutionary history saw the emergence of the axial sages, these axial sages had given us, or have given us, insight into yet another physiological response that we'll be using during this course, all through this course. The third response to emerge in the human nervous system is what is called the restful alertness response. And this is the response that we will all be eliciting during this conference, during the next few days. In fact, it will be the basis of understanding a lot that we are going to explore this week. The restful awareness response is the ability of the nervous system to go beyond the eyes of perception, the eyes of the flesh, to go beyond the eyes of the mind into literally the eyes of the soul or spirit. It's the response that gave rise to the literature and the theoretical framework that we'll be exploring. Because whatever we explore in the world of so-called reality, first of all, it's based on a certain conceptual framework, but that certain conceptual framework also comes from a certain methodology. So anything that we explore, and if we want to call it science, any scientific discipline that we want to explore has three ingredients to it. First, there's a methodology. Then as a result of that methodology, there's an experience. I want to look at the craters on the moon, right? And the methodology is I have to have the right instruments, telescope and so on. And then when I can use those instruments, then I can see the craters on the moon. Well, that's the experience. And the third ingredient of any scientific exploration is that I must be able to share that methodology and that experience with my peers. And if I say, well, you know, look at this telescope, this is how it works, you look through it, you'll see the craters of the moon. They also see the craters of the moon. We have an agreement. We have a similar experience. And that collective agreement then becomes our science. That's how science always works. A methodology, an experience, and an agreement. And what happens is that there are many ways of using the methodology. The methodology can be physical, which means using the eyes of the flesh. The eyes of the flesh is our sensory experience. What we see, what we hear, what we touch, what we taste and smell. This is the eyes of the flesh. And all the instruments of science are nothing other than prostheses or extensions of the eyes of the flesh. So that's one methodology for exploring so-called reality. A second methodology for exploring so-called reality is the eyes of the mind, which is beyond the eyes of the flesh. If I want to understand the theorem of Pythagoras, then I have to know the methodology that employs the understanding of Euclidean geometry. And then I can say to you, well, this is the methodology of Euclidean geometry. And if you employ this methodology, you'll get an aha experience. You'll understand the theorem of Pythagoras. And then you and I will share the same experience. So that's the second kind of methodology, the eyes of the mind. And the third kind of methodology, which emerged about 6,000 years ago in our history, is what is called the eye of the soul, the eye of the spirit, which says that there is yet another way to explore the world beyond the eyes of the flesh, beyond the eyes of the mind. It is through the disciplines that have come down to us through the wisdom traditions of the world, the disciplines of meditation, which allow us to go into the experience of restful alertness, which is beyond mind and body, beyond the eyes of the mind, beyond the eyes of the flesh, and explore yet another aspect of reality. And if I can share with you that methodology, then you will have the same experience. And if we agree on that same experience, then it's just as valid a science as the eyes of the flesh or the eyes of the mind. So with this ability to elicit the restful alertness response, which, as I said, was the methodology that was employed by the axial sages, a whole new world of experience opened to humanity. And it is from this new world of experience that the knowledge of Ayurveda and consciousness-based medicine is derived, that we'll be going through this whole week. Because with the ability to elicit the restful alertness response, came the ability to elicit yet another response, and that was called the intuitive response. The intuitive response is to go into the eyes of the soul, through the eyes of the soul, into the realm of this deeper reality, which is beyond mind and body, and actually access a form of intelligence which is very different from our intellectual intelligence. Our intellectual intelligence is rational, it's linear, it is based on direct cause and effect. This is the cause of this, and this results in this, logic. Whereas the eye of intuition, or the intuitive response, goes to a deeper level of intelligence, which is more contextual, which is more relational, which is more holistic, which looks at the world at many levels of existence, which is more intuitive, more nourishing, more wise, does not have a direct win-lose orientation, and is not based on direct linear cause-effect relationships. This is the intuitive response. And when the ancient sages of the Upanishads discovered the intuitive response, they exclaimed, there's a famous expression that comes from the Vedic literature, yatha pinde tatha brahmande, which says, as is the atom, so is the universe. As is the human body, so is the cosmic body. As is the human mind, so is the cosmic mind. And that there is an inner intelligence within us, which is the ultimate and supreme genius. It mirrors the wisdom of the universe, and it's beyond rational thought, but it's much more precise in its computing system, and much more accurate, actually. And that's the next response that humans had. And as a result of the intuitive response, they developed yet another response, which can only be called the creative response, in which they developed the ability to create something that seemingly never existed before, a new combination of elements and forces in the human consciousness to create something that actually had no existence before. The creative response. And from the creative response came yet another response, the visionary response, to see as a result of that new creation a vision of possibilities of what is possible in the future, what is possible in the field of pure potentiality, which doesn't exist now, but to have a vision of what we can create in the future. And from the visionary response came the next response, the sacred response, having created something that never existed before, having a vision for the possibilities in the future. How does that allow me to get in touch with the Creator herself, or the Creator himself, or the Creator itself, whatever word you want to use, to get in touch with that part of us which is infinite and unbounded? So in the last 7,000 years, we can see that in terms of just the evolution of our own consciousness, a term that I like to use, the word metabiological evolution. Darwinian evolution was all about survival of the fittest, was all about who was the best predator. But metabiological evolution is about the evolution of our own consciousness. We see that metabiological evolution, which is the evolution of consciousness and ultimately consciousness of consciousness, takes us beyond the primitive responses of fight, flight and reaction, reactive responses, to restful awareness, intuitive responses, creative responses, visionary responses, sacred responses. These are the seven basic responses that the human nervous system is capable of. The whole scientific edifice of Ayurveda is built on the ability to elicit these responses. And as I mentioned to you, this whole knowledge evolved about 4,000 to 6,000 years ago. About the early part of 17th, 18th and 19th centuries, though, something else happened. And what really happened was that we saw the emergence, particularly in the Western Hemisphere, of great scientists. I don't need to name all of them, but the principal one that everyone seems to relate to, who created the new paradigm that took us away from the age of agriculture into the mechanistic and industrial age, was Isaac Newton, with very elegant methodologies of the mind and also eyes of the flesh and eyes of the mind, he developed a new conceptual framework. And the new conceptual framework explained everything in the universe in mechanistic terms, which means that matter became the God. Invisible forces disappeared for a while, and invisible forces, even though they were acknowledged, gravity being the most important, and electromagnetic forces also, even though they were acknowledged, in fact, the whole basis of understanding of these forces was a mechanistic worldview. If you can understand the nature of matter, then you can understand everything. If you can understand how molecules behave, then you can understand everything. And with that mechanistic worldview, we saw the emergence of our so-called modern scientific medicine as well. Modern scientific medicine is the offspring of the mechanistic worldview, which looks at the world through the eyes of the flesh, the eyes of the mind, and says, if I understand the nature of molecules, then I should understand the nature of the universe. The universe is like a big mechanical clock. It has all these parts to it. If I understand the parts and how they work, then I know how the clock works. And so this mechanistic worldview also gave rise, and this is part of our industrial age, emerged with it, and with this came the anatomical worldview of human beings. We are basically looked at as physical machines that have learned how to manufacture thoughts. Human beings are a wonderful machine, and consciousness is the byproduct. The invisible forces are byproducts. If you think, if you fall in love, if you believe in God or heaven or hell or salvation or damnation, you can understand all this by understanding how molecules behave. And with this worldview also came the whole notion that with the right drug, with the right mechanistic intervention, with the right technology, it was possible to cure any illness as well. This is the paradigm that brought us right into our current age in the early part of this century. We saw the emergence of great breakthroughs actually in scientific medicine, antibiotics and all kinds of other pharmaceuticals. So the understanding was, if I know how bacteria multiply, can interfere with that with the appropriate antibiotic, then I shouldn't have infections anymore. If I understand how cancer cells replicate in the DNA, can interfere with that with the appropriate chemotherapeutic drug, you should get rid of cancer. If you know how hydrochloric acid binds to its receptor sites in stomach walls, interfere with that with the appropriate H2 receptor blocker, shouldn't have ulcers anymore, etc., etc. All of modern science is based on one fundamental premise. If I know the mechanics of something, the mechanism of something, and if I can learn how to interfere with it, then I should be able to change it. So all of science is, this is the fundamental premise. Unfortunately, we didn't realize until recently that mechanisms of illness are not the origins of illness. Mechanisms of illness are not the origins of illness. The origins of illness have to do with how life expresses itself through the human body-mind. And these are processes that we will discover, which we'll discuss, which we'll go over in great detail during this week. Processes like eating and breathing and digestion and metabolism and elimination and the world of sensory experience, what we hear and what we touch and what we see and taste and smell, and an inner life that we all have of thought and feeling and emotion and desire and memories and dreams. These are the processes that in fact influence what happens in our life. This is how life expresses itself through the human body mind. Not paying attention to the fact that the origins of illness are not the same as the mechanisms of illness, we went under the premise that if we could just understand the mechanism of illness, we would be able to take care of it. But even though scientific medicine made major breakthroughs, and I want you to all be very sure during this week that we have nothing against scientific medicine. scientific modern medicine is extremely effective in acute illnesses and can save your life. But it's incomplete. That's the whole thing that we want to understand. It's not holistic in its totality. It's not holistic because in order to be holistic, it has to understand the body, it has to understand the mind, it has to understand the soul, it has to understand the spirit, it has to understand the environment. Scientific medicine, in which we were trained, David and I, we became really superb technicians who knew almost everything about the human body and absolutely nothing about the human soul, because there was no fundamental basis for understanding the soul. This mechanistic worldview has ruled medicine till recent decades. And now we are seeing a shift again in the paradigm, which is completely mechanistic, completely part of the industrial age, into a new shift in medicine. And this comes from the worldview that literally saw the breakdown of the superstition of materialism. Because in the early part of the century, what happened is there were major discoveries by scientists like Niels Bohr and many others, Heisenberg and many, many other scientists, great scientists, quantum physicists, who said that if you really begin to look at material things and understand the nature of matter, you'll understand that it's not material. Matter is made up of atoms. The atoms in turn are made up of subatomic particles, and the subatomic particles are not things. They are fluctuations of energy and information. And so we saw the emergence in the early part of this century of what we can call the information age, and we're in it at the moment. The industrial age is gone, and we have now the information age, where everything is based on an understanding of nature as a field of energy and information. So I think everyone in this room is familiar with Einstein's famous equation, E is equal to mc squared. Without going into the mathematics of it, what that equation says, that energy and matter are the same thing. That you can take energy and you can create matter out of it. You can take matter and create energy out of it. That is the early part of the century. But now, during the later part of the century, what scientists are saying is that there's a third part to this equation that we have ignored. And that third part is information. Okay, so energy is equal to matter, but is also equal to information. That, in fact, everything that exists has these three components to it. Everything that exists has these three components to it. Matter, energy, and information. Anything. So you take a piece of meat, medium rare steak, it's matter, but it's also energy. That's why when you eat it, you use that energy for, you convert that matter into energy that you can employ in activities. Physical activity, mental activity, but it has information in it. There's cholesterol and there's all this other stuff, carbohydrate and protein, and you look at that and there's even finer levels of information in that piece of meat. But that's true of this table. It's matter, it's energy, there are subatomic forces here, and these subatomic forces are not just states of energy, they're hierarchies of states of information. That the entire material world, from mineral to plant to animal, is made up of these three components. These three components are ubiquitous in nature. You know, when I was thinking about this a couple of weeks ago, and the three words that came to mind were omnipresence, omnipotent, and omniscience. As matter is omnipresent everywhere in the universe. Energy is everywhere. That's omnipotence. Energy is everywhere in the universe. And information is everywhere in the universe. That's omniscience. So those are the essential qualities of spirit, which manifests as information, energy, and matter. Omnipresence, omnipotence, and omniscience. We'll go into the different levels of spirit later this evening. So this was the information age that brought us to where we are today. And from the information age, we are on just a stepping off phase. We are going to leave the information age soon into what can only be called the age of consciousness. Because now we are recognizing that the essential raw material of the universe is not just matter, energy, and information, but it is actually intelligence. And I would like to define intelligence for you for our purposes. Intelligence is the same thing as awareness. And I'd like to really spend a few minutes, because this is the basis of our whole course, that the raw material of the universe, raw material, is matter plus energy plus information. And they are actually the same thing in different disguises. Because anything that's material is also broken down into its energy component, and anything that has energy in it has states of information in it. An atom, which is the basic unit of matter, is not just a solid entity. In fact, it is not a solid entity. An atom, which is the basic unit of matter, is a hierarchy of states of information and energy. So, as I've explained to you, the seven different responses that we have seen in human nervous system are fight, flight, reactive, restful alertness, intuitive, creative, visionary, sacred. And the different stages of our evolution have gone through the age of hunter-gatherer, horticulture, agriculture, industrial age or mechanistic age, information age, and now the age of consciousness. And so the paradigm has changed. And today, we are recognizing that the raw material of the universe, as we go from gross to subtle levels, is information, but actually not just information, it's intelligence. And intelligence is information that has built into it a quality, which you'll hear a lot about this week, called self-referral. Self-referral, which means that this is not dead information. The essential raw material of the universe is not just dead information. It is information that is living and alive. And what makes it living and alive is this quality of self-referral. So I want to explain what that means. Quality of self-referral, it means information that has a feedback loop. And in physics and mathematics, this principle is called cybernetics. Cybernetics. Information that influences its own expression. And these feedback loops are of various kinds. Positive and negative feedback loops. We'll learn more about that during this week. So information that influences its own expression through feedback is intelligence. And as a result of this feedback loop, information becomes intelligence and develops the ability to evolve. Evolve means it changes. it transforms itself. And as it transforms itself, then it feeds back on its own self again, and then it transforms itself again. And it keeps on transforming itself into higher levels of creativity, abstraction, and unpredictability. These are the hallmarks of intelligence. As intelligence evolves from just being information, then it acquires these characteristics: creativity, abstraction, and unpredictability. If the IBM computer was able to defeat Kasparov, it was because the computer technologists were able to incorporate these properties into that machine. The greater the degree of unpredictability, you go beyond the mere reactive response into the ability to choose from an infinity of possibilities. And this is what is now being seen as the essential raw material of the universe. That so-called intelligence, which I'm using synonymously, by the way, with spirit, and I will talk about that, synonymously with spirit, is the underlying ground of creation. And as we will now be basing our entire series of lectures on this essential model that I have constructed for you, which is this consciousness, intelligence and consciousness are the same thing. Therefore, consciousness is the ultimate ground of creation. Consciousness is the ultimate substance from which all substances emerge. And consciousness is synonymous with spirit, intelligence, information, which is self-referral, which creates, which evolves, and is continuing to evolve. So we are on the threshold now, the information age, we are leaving it, emerging into the age of consciousness, where we begin to understand the nature of intelligence in ourselves, in nature, and then the ability to use that intelligence to evoke what the healing response is. This is the basis of what we'll be doing the rest of this week. This is the understanding. No longer can we look at our body in purely anatomical terms. It's not anatomical. It's a river of intelligence, a river of information, a river of energy. The old paradigm, which was the mechanistic or industrial age paradigm, looked at the world made up of independent objects, independent of a perceiver. The new paradigm is built on the insights from quantum physics and neurosciences, as well as the cognitions of the great axial sages, seers, which says that we live in a participatory universe. Our attention creates and modifies the objects of our awareness. And in physics, this principle is also called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, where you cannot know the position or the velocity of a particle at the same time. It's your decision to know one or the other that actually manifests the other. The second tenet of the old paradigm, the material world, which includes human beings, is made up of clumps of matter separated from each other in space and time. The new paradigm says the world is non-material. It is composed of energy fields, which come from one underlying unmanifest field. We'll discuss that. Space-time events are part of this field. The old paradigm, which says mind and matter are different and independent entities. The new paradigm, which says that mind and matter are essentially the same. The field experienced subjectively is the mind, objectively is the world of material objects. And as we go through this course, you'll see that our thoughts and our emotions, which are impulses of intelligence, states of information and energy, transform themselves into molecules, neuropeptides, which are found in the brain, but they're found in all the other cells of the body. They modify the activity of the immune system, and in fact, the same neuropeptides are produced by the cells of our body. So the mind is not here. Every cell is simultaneously a mind, and it's part of a universe which is a huge mind. and it's infinite and unbounded. We are participating with that universal mind. And we'll go into that in great detail as well. The old paradigm, it said that the mind is trapped in the brain, intelligence is localized in the nervous system, or at most in the body. The new paradigm, which says that the mind is not trapped in the brain, or even in the body. It extends far beyond the reaches of the cosmos. It is infinite, unbounded. By what do we mean by that universal mind? We mean that non-local field of energy and information with self-referral cybernetic feedback loops. The same way our mind operates, that field of universal energy and information operates in exactly the same way that our own mind operates. Just the only difference is it doesn't think in English and doesn't have an Indian accent. Okay? It's infinite, unbounded. It may find expression in localized forms and phenomena, but the whole universe is this intelligent field. When it interacts with itself, which means when it thinks, the material world appears to manifest. So intelligence cannot be localized, only its expressions can, because it's universal, it's unbounded, it's everywhere. The old paradigm said that consciousness was the epiphenomenon of matter, a byproduct of matter. We are physical machines that have learned to think. And the new paradigm says that matter is the epiphenomenon of consciousness. That in our essential nature, we are thoughts. We are a localized bundle of thought. By thought, I mean information and energy with self-referral feedback loops. And that these are quantum events. A quantum in physics is defined as the smallest indivisible unit of information or energy. A quantum in physics is the smallest indivisible unit of information and energy, in which waves of information and energy are either emitted or absorbed. So a quantum of light, for example, is called a photon. A quantum of electricity called an electron. A quantum of gravity is called a graviton. But what's a thought? It's also a unit of information and energy. So if you have the thought, I'm going to wiggle my toes, then that thought has two components. Energy, otherwise your toes wouldn't wiggle. If thoughts did not have energy or an animating life force, we would all be paralyzed. And information. And just like the whole universe is made up of energy and information, which becomes material things, so too our physical body is the material expression of these quantum events. We are essentially bundles of thought that are manifesting as molecules. The old paradigm said that human beings are self-contained, independent entities, and now we recognize that we are not self-contained, independent, but we are focal points in that unified field, that whole ocean of intelligence, consciousness, energy, and information. And we are inseparably connected, interconnected with the patterns of intelligence in the whole cosmos. We are a web of relationships. And this is interesting to understand. So, you know, even our physical bodies are in relationship to each other as part of that field. And our emotional, intellectual, mental, spiritual bodies are in relationship to each other. We are, in fact, a set of relationships. So even with one breath that you breathe in 10 to the power of 22 atoms, which is a huge amount of raw material that comes into your body. With each breath you breathe out 10 to the power of 22 atoms that go out from every little cell of your body. You're literally breathing out bits and pieces of your heart and kidney and brain tissue. And technically speaking, we're all intimately sharing our organs with each other all the time. Factually, you can do radioactive isotope studies and you can show that you have in your body right now a million atoms that were once in the body of Christ or Buddha or Moses or Gandhi or Saddam Hussein or Genghis Khan or anyone that you want to think about. In just the last 3 weeks, a quadrillion atoms have gone through your body that have gone through the body of every other living species on our planet. So think of a tree in Africa, a squirrel in Siberia, a peasant in China, and you have atoms, raw material in your body that was circulating there about 3 weeks ago. And in about 1 year, you replace almost all the atoms in your body. A new liver every 6 weeks, a new stomach lining every 5 days, a new skeleton every 3 months. Even the DNA, which holds the memories of millions of years of evolutionary time, the actual raw material, the carbon, the hydrogen, the oxygen, the nitrogen, it comes and goes every 6 weeks. So the physical body you have today is not the same as the physical body you had a year ago or 2 years ago, down to the last atom, because you're constantly, we are recycled earth and water and space and air and fire, recycled elements that are constantly and ever in dynamic exchange with everything else that's also constantly and ever in dynamic exchange in that field of transformations. So our physical bodies are never, never the same. In fact, we are changing our physical bodies as effortlessly as we change our clothes all the time. Therefore, our sense of identity, if it comes from our physical body, it's an illusory sense of identity. We are not our physical bodies, which are part of the body of the universe. And the body of the universe is constantly and ever in dynamic exchange within itself, and we are part of that field. Now, the same thing holds true of our subtle body or our emotional body or our thoughts, because our thoughts are not our own. Nietzsche, the German philosopher, once said, we live under the presumption that we think, but most of the time we are being thought. And we are being thought by this collective field. In other words, every thought that we have is context-bound. It emerges out of a context, and that context is cultural, it's historical, it's religious, it's mythological. No single thought arises by itself. It is context-bound. Let's say 100 years ago, you said to somebody, I'm going to take American Airlines and go to Disney World. They wouldn't know what you're talking about. Okay, because that thought, I'm going to take American Airlines to Disney World, comes out of a context of history that has emerged over the last 100 years. It's part of the collective psyche, that particular thought. It's based on all that history and all the mythology. When you say, I'm going to see Mickey Mouse, that's part of our collective mythology at the moment. Wouldn't have meant anything to anyone even 70 years ago. So even our thoughts are constantly part of that dynamic field of energy and information. We can't link our identity neither to the physical body, nor to our thoughts, nor to our emotions, which are also context-bound, which are part of a collective mix, nor to our personalities, because our personalities are also transforming, just like our body transforms. It's transforming, it's evolving, it's growing, it's changing. So I can't anchor my identity even to my personality. I'm a dynamic bundle of information and energy, and more than that, I'm a dynamic bundle of intelligence that is constantly and ever in dynamic exchange with the universe of intelligence. And as I continue to evolve, there is no one thing that I can say is me. There's no one thing that I can say that's me in this field of change. There's a field of non-change that we can anchor ourselves to, and we'll go into that later. But I want us to begin to look at ourselves not as these physical bodies, because everything we'll be learning this week is based on a paradigm which says that which I call my physical body is just the place that my memories and dreams call home for the time being. And even my memories and dreams are constantly changing. I'm not my memories and dreams. I'm a deeper level of existence which goes through these transformations. So we are not self-contained independent entities, but focal points in the unified field. And I will discuss the unified field in detail. We are inseparably connected with the patterns of intelligence that permeate the whole cosmos. We are a web of relationships. Our bodies, old paradigm said, our bodies have well-defined edges, because that's what the eyes of the flesh said. This is a well-defined edge to our body. We are separate. The new paradigm says there are no well-defined edges to our body. We are not separate. And we are totally interdependent inseparable. Our bodies are changing, pulsating patterns, a part of the whole process. Our body is part of the universal body. Our mind is part of the universal mind. And then there were a couple of other ideas there, and that have to do with the whole notion of even space and time being structured out of this field. Because, again, in the early part of the century, Einstein said that time is relative. Everyone knows that. Okay, that it depends on the speed of the observer and the position of the observer. But what Einstein did not explain was the fact that we can have different experiences of time while experiencing the same thing, being in the same place. So what Einstein did not say is time is not just dependent on the speed and position of the observer, it is dependent on the observation that you are making. Time is dependent, the experience of time is dependent on the observation that you are making. So if the observation that you're making is, I'm having a good time, then what happens? Time flies. If the observation that you're making is that I'm bored, then time drags. If the observation that you're making is, I'm running out of time, then you actually start to run out of time. Even your biological clock speeds up. So we know a lot of people whose internal dialogue is, I'm running out of time. They look at the same clocks that you and I see, but for them they're moving much faster. So if you examine these people, you'll find they have speeded up biological clocks. Faster heart rates, jittery platelets with high levels of adrenaline. Even the platelets are scared. They're huddling together in their fright. Everything is in the fast lane. Insulin, glucagon, cortisol, adrenaline. When they suddenly drop dead of a premature heart attack, then of course they've run out of time. And then some people's internal dialogue seems to be, I have all the time in the world. You'll find that their biological clock is different, slower. And then, of course, we've all had the experience, especially when we were playing as children or as adults, maybe when we were in love or when we were moved by great poetry or music or art or in prayer or meditation, when we lost track of time altogether. As when you say, the beauty of the sunset was breathtaking, time stood still. That experience is going beyond all change, where the observer and the observed become one. And then there is no time. So time, the experience of it, depends on the observation that you're making. If our attention is always on that which is constantly changing, and we'll see the different levels of change, then our biological clock reflects that. But if our attention could go to something that is timeless and doesn't change, then our biological clock would come to a standstill for that period, which we would experience as timeless. And we will discuss the relevance of that, the practical relevance to that, when we discuss the mechanics of aging. Because even the experience of time is a manifestation of the measurement that we are making. And if the measurement is in the realm of the relative, where everything is changing, then time accelerates. If there is no measurement, which is the reality, you know, the reality of the universe, is that it's infinite, it's unbounded. It's timeless. There are no edges in space, and there's no beginning and there's no ending in time. And if our attention is on the most primordial level of our own existence, then even the quality of our biological clock will change, because the experience of time depends on the measurements that you wish to make. So in Vedic terminology, there is a word for that measurement. It's called Maya. And very frequently when people translate the word Maya from Sanskrit, they translate as illusion. But that's not the right translation. The word Maya actually means measurement. It's the origin of the word matter. Because matter is a measurement of something that actually can't be measured, the infinite unbounded field of spirit. So matter, meter, which is the way we measure, so many meters, music, which is another way of measuring rhythmically that which is immeasurable, matter, music, meter, measurement, mother, which is the womb of creation where we start the measurement, you know, we start measuring as soon as we are born, mother, mater, mata, matrika, all these are different words that imply measurement or giving some degree of quantification to something that is unquantifiable. And that something is the ultimate ground of creation, which is the field itself. The field itself, which is spirit, which is intelligence, which is consciousness. And now, having said that, the rest of the week is actually going to be how we measure that which is unmeasurable. And having understood those different ways of measuring, we begin to see how we create balance in something which is essentially self-balancing. In fact, what we do when we get ill or unbalanced is we interfere with that spontaneous self-referral process. So this evening, when I come back, we'll focus our attention totally on the field. And this during the rest of the day, we'll be focusing our attention on the measurable aspects of the field. This evening, we'll go back into the infinite, immeasurable potential of all that was, is, and will be, which is the field itself. Einstein, in the early part of the century, when he started his theories, he said, in the new physics, there is no place for matter and the field at the same time. In the ultimate reality, the field is the only reality. And the field, which is spirit or intelligence or consciousness, it is the ultimate and only reality. And as it curves back within its own self, its measurements can be quantified as the activities of the mind, of the body, and of the universe. But the field by itself is the potential for space-time events. It's not a model for space-time events. It's the potential for space-time events. So the mind and the body and the physical universe are the space-time events that we measure. The field itself is unmeasurable. This is the paradigm that we'll be working through for the rest of this week. We'll go back from the unmeasurable into the measurable. And then we'll go from the measurable back to the unmeasurable. Infinity to that which is finite, immortality to that which is mortal, back and forth, till we understand both theoretically and hopefully experientially that we are both simultaneously. The infinite and the finite, the immortal and the mortal, the unbounded and the bounded, the immeasurable and the measurable.